By the U of I's Center for Advanced Study, whose Millercom 2007 series presents Imagining the New Media Encounter by Alan Liu on Friday, April 20th at 4 p.m. in room 314B of the Illini Union on the U of I campus. More information is available at www.cas.uiuc.edu. WILL programming is made possible in part by Illinois American Water. The employees of Illinois American Water are proud to serve Champaign County and are focused on being a good steward of the Mahomet Aquifer by funding research to help protect and preserve this valuable water source for future generations.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. On the program today, our topic is family, in particular, the path of one American family from 19th century Europe to the U.S. in the 21st century. Our guest is media historian Lou Leibovich. His latest book is Abraham's Rhyme, the story of an American family. The family is his. Let me share this from the book's prologue. America is not about fame, it's about heart. No family is typical and no experience is unique, but the collective American existence is composed of the sum of its parts. Human accomplishment comes in small bits and pieces, a halting process fraught with human failings. This book is about frailty and perseverance. That's from the opening of Lou Leibovich's book, Abraham's Rhyme. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon. You can join the conversation with a telephone call. Here are the numbers. In the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. A former investigative reporter, Lou Leibovich, is research professor of communications, professor of media studies, and professor of journalism at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. His previous books include The Press and the Modern Presidency and Richard Nixon, Watergate, and the U.S. News Media. His new book, Abraham's Rhyme, is published by Nightingale Press. And by the way, our guest will be in the author's corner of the Illini Union Bookstore next Thursday afternoon, April 26, 2007, from 4 to 6 p.m. Again, the phone number is 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
Very nice to see you here in the studio with me. You resisted writing the story of your family for quite some time. Why?
Well, it always occurred to me that writing about your family might be interesting to you, but is it interesting to anyone else? I resisted because I was maybe propagandized to believe that. And after a while, as I got into it and studied people that I hadn't seen for a while, I realized maybe it was a more interesting story than I was giving it credit for.
So then, in the end, you realized, you know, it's not about fame, it's about heart, and there's some things here that people would be drawn to. I think there's some kind of universal themes in terms of America and American family. When you and your brothers were growing up, was there a story that was told over and over again when the family gathered? And how did you begin the process of researching the book?
Well, we'd heard stories in bits and pieces. Probably didn't listen very carefully. You know how the baby boomers are. The world started in 1945, and there were things that we were told maybe over and over again, but didn't really sink in very well. When I started to research it, in fact, my grandfather was from Romania, as was my grandmother, and I thought they were from Transylvania. We used to make jokes about getting hair growing on our faces and getting long teeth when the moon was full. But actually, when I researched it, I found out they weren't from Transylvania. They were from Moldavia, which is another province in Romania, but I hadn't really known which part of Romania they were from. I hadn't even thought about it. And so it was kind of interesting to research this place from which they came and to learn some things about it that I had never known.
Yeah. The story begins in 1856 in Romania. It begins with a story involving your grandfather's father, Abraham. He's a boy of five, and he's hiding under his parents' bed. What was happening?
There was a pogrom. A pogrom was an anti-Semitic rampage by Christians in the community. They happened frequently. The farmers used to come into town to sell their vegetables on Tuesdays and Thursdays, and if they had too much to drink, they would go into the Jewish section of town and they would rampage, destroy things, beat people up, rape some women.
Yeah. So how did Abraham's father comfort his son?
Well, there was a little ditty that went through the family for those 150 years. Mm. It was, he would place his finger on his son's chest, and he would place his finger on his chest, and he'd go back and forth, saying these words. And my father used to do that to us, and we got in the habit of doing that to our children, and I never knew what it meant. Mm. And I researched and found out nobody knows what it means. it was just a nonsensical part of the Romanian language, which was not really words. It was just something that I guess my great-grandfather had made up.
Yeah. Kind of a sort of a fun rhyme.
Well, it was a way of diverting your attention.
Right.
They would use it at times when the kids were having problems or, you know, in the beginning of the book, it's right after the pogrom, the kids are hiding under the bed and he comes home and they're scared to death and he tries to divert their attention by playing empathy.
Yeah. What kind of stories about Abraham have survived over the years?
Not very many. He was kind of a shadowy figure. He died in 1912 at a fairly young age, but I guess he was a towering man. He had red hair, which is somewhat unusual for Eastern Europeans. And he was a tall man. He was a powerful man, but he never used his fists, nor did he resort to any sort of physical violence because he believed in using his wits, that violence would only beget violence.
Yeah, well, it's an interesting story you tell in the book about Abraham outsmarting a tough customer, actually someone who wanted to take him.
Yeah, he's a peddler, and he's traveling along the road, and the guy jumps out from the woods, and he's going to steal what he wants from the wagon, and by the time the conversation ends, Abraham has talked him into buying a bottle of wine and paying for it, twice as much as he paid for it.
Yeah, and he comes home and tells the story. And the lesson is, use your head. What was life like there for this family in Romania, mid-19th century, late 19th century?
They lived under constant fear. Almost everyone who lived in rural Romania was poor. And they had a house, they didn't live on the street, but it was basically a one-room house with five children, and they drew water from a well. They had enough to eat, but not plenty, and they were constantly in fear of someone attacking them, or in the case of the older boys, they're being conscripted into the military.
Yeah. And Abraham and his wife, Fanny, they had five children. And the children were Sam, Srul, is that correct?
That's correct.
Louis, Rachel, and Anna.
Yes.
And they all grew up. And Sam was the first to decide he would leave to come to the U.S.
Yeah, he came to Beloit, Wisconsin.
Of all things. Yeah.
Well, he was a shoemaker, and I guess they had a shoe repair shop that they needed someone, and in those days, the ethnic groups would help to place people from other ethnic groups or from their ethnic group who were coming to the country, and so the Jewish Relief Organization found a shoe repair shop for him in Beloit, Wisconsin, 7,000 people.
Yeah, and so there he made a life. Lewis wanted to follow, but the army, as you alluded to, had other ideas.
Yeah, he was conscripted. They came to the village and rounded up all the young men they could find and conscripted in the army. And when you were Jewish and you were conscripted in the army in Romania, you usually didn't get out for the rest of your life.
Yeah. But Lewis managed to get out.
Well, he walked away.
He did. And who could blame him?
Yeah, they were on border patrol in Hungary, and they hadn't had any food supplies in 2 weeks, and their uniforms were in tatters, and it was raining, and they were in a shack that was leaking. And so they got into underneath a pile of hay in a hay wagon and went into Hungary, and then he made his way to Italy and then to the United States.
Yeah. To Italy, and then to Ellis Island, and then to, was it Beloit or South Beloit?
It was Beloit. South Beloit's in Illinois.
Right. And did he find his brother?
Yes. He after a three-day train ride from New York, he gets off the train and finds his brother.
And then 1910, we find him in Chicago, where he hates it.
Yeah, he was a small-town boy. And most Jews were from larger cities, but there were a number of them that lived in Moldavia provinces in the smaller communities. His hometown, Panchu, was actually 52% Jewish. And so he liked the small towns, but in the United States, small towns didn't have Jews. So he, on the one hand, wanted to be in a small town, on the other hand, wanted to be around Jews, so he eventually found his way to Chicago.
Yeah, and Chicago was a pretty tough place in 1910.
Yeah, pickpockets and people that were roaming the streets, and he made a living by selling fruits and vegetables off a peddler's wagon.
Yeah. You know, this is where the story also, I think, resonates with me, because my grandmother, my father's mother, came from Ireland, and it would have been roughly around this time as well. And she and her sisters made their way to Chicago, and they were orphans. And I can't imagine, you know, what life was like. They eventually became domestic servants, and then things went on from there. And I imagine that, you know, this is where, as you mentioned, the story, you know, is there are universal things here in this story.
Yeah, and also I'd like to point out that my mother's stepfather was Irish, and so there's a description of his roots going back to County Cork in Ireland. This isn't just about a Jewish family. My mother's parents were English, so we go back to 1880s England, we go back to 1850s Ireland, and we go back to the turn of the century in Italy.
Yeah. So we've got the Glavins and Pollards and the Italian family.
Cassiopi.
Very interesting. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon is Lou Leibovich. He's a media historian, but his latest book is about his family, Abraham's Rhyme, the story of an American family. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let me mention that our guest will be in the author's corner of the Illini Union Bookstore next Thursday afternoon, April 26th, 2007, from 4 to 6 p.m. What does the family think about the book?
Most of them like it.
Yeah. What are the complaints? Like, that never happened, or why did you tell that story?
No, I think maybe they all wanted me to put the best face on who they were and what they did. And sometimes putting the best face on one person put the bad face on another person. I didn't try to varnish anything. I pretty much, there are some things in there are pretty stark. But I got signed waivers from all of them, so I guess I'm covered.
Yeah. Well, one of the stories you tell in the book is about your dad and your mom marrying secretly.
Yeah. They, both sets of parents didn't like the fact they were going together. And so they had to sneak off to Iowa to get married. And, he was driving a scrap truck and didn't have enough money to buy his own truck. He was actually driving his father's scrap truck. So he told my mother that they could get married, but they couldn't reveal the marriage, that she'd have to go back home and live for a few months till he could earn enough money to buy his own scrap truck. So they eloped to Iowa and were back that night, and
all hell broke loose.
Yeah, the stepfather wasn't too happy, and so she spent her wedding day driving in a drafty truck to Iowa and back, having her wedding night dinner in Walgreens, where they shared a dinner, and then driving back home when she was beaten by her stepfather that night.
Your grandfather wasn't too happy about this either.
No, he said that somebody made an anonymous phone call to the house to tell him that my father had married my mother, and he said at that moment that my father was dead to him.
Wow. Did your grandfather ever make peace with it?
Yeah, they got married in Jewish ceremony some 4 months later, and he tolerated her after that, although she grew fairly close to my father's mother.
Yeah. And your mom converted to Judaism, is that correct?
Yes, four months after the first wedding.
Yeah, it's such a big story, Lou.
Well, that was an unusual thing in those days. Conversion today is reasonably frequent. People, I think, are more thoughtful about these things. But in those days, it was like abandoning your heritage to convert. And it didn't happen that often.
Yeah. Your grandfather and his wife, your grandmother, Bess, they eventually moved from Chicago to Rockford. How did they make that choice?
Well, when they got married, he had enough. First of all, he didn't get along too well with his mother-in-law. And so 90 miles away from Chicago was just fine with him. Also, as I said, he really never was very pleased living in Chicago. He was a small-town boy. And his brother had moved from Beloit to Rockford in the interim because there was a larger market for a shoe repair operation. So his brother invited them to live with his family right after they got married, which was frequently done in those days. You didn't have money for your own house or even for an apartment. You just lived with relatives till you could get out on your own. So he moved back to Rockford to live with his brother and his wife and children.
Hmm. Was there a synagogue in Rockford at that time?
It was not a formal synagogue in the sense there was a building. There was a congregation, but they would meet first in people's houses, and then they would rent buildings wherever they could. They moved around several different buildings in the downtown Rockford area until 1924, when they bought an old Swedish church and made a synagogue out of it, an Orthodox synagogue.
Yeah. Well, as I told you before we started the interview, I grew up in Rockford, and when I grew up, there was a Jewish community center, and I spent a lot of time there. Myself with the Brownies and the Girl Scouts and that kind of thing. So eventually the Jewish community in Rockford must have grown substantially.
Yes, there were two congregations in Rockford. One was Reformed and one was Orthodox. And they both grew exponentially in the 20th century. Part of the closing of the book is talking about how the Jewish community has changed in Rockford. That is to say, the Orthodox synagogue moved to another part of town, but it's got very few members now. Orthodox Judaism outside of large cities is not very popular anymore. And a lot of the old Jewish community, which was fairly tight-knit because it was the immigrants and the children of immigrants, I mean, you didn't have to introduce anybody at the synagogue. Everybody knew everybody. That's all sort of gone by the wayside. There are very few of my generation from that synagogue still left in town.
Yeah. In the book, you tell the story of 1960s Rockford, the Rockford Country Club, which I suppose it is still the most prestigious country club in the city.
Uh-huh.
No Jews allowed.
Well, there are now, but there weren't historically. The town kind of, there's three country clubs in Rockford. They kind of divided. The Montesi was for the Italians, and Forest Hills was for the Scandinavians, and Rockford Country Club was for the old line rich. It wasn't a vicious kind of division, but it was just a natural division that occurred over the years.
Yeah. Well, going back to my growing up in Rockford, it seemed to me that even when I was a kid or when I became aware of it, it seemed that The east side of the river had been settled by Scandinavians and the west side Italians. And I remember talking to people who would be, a woman who would be our parents' generation. And she was an Italian woman, and she found it very hard trying to get a teaching job because she was Italian.
Well, that would probably be in the 30s, and I wouldn't doubt that. The Scandinavians are historically in Rockford were the largest percentage of the population, and the Italians were the second largest. And they didn't have a lot in common, and they didn't mix well. But I think by the time that the 60s rolled around, that had changed quite a bit because, I mean, I had a lot of Swedish-American friends. I had a lot of Italian-American friends. And they mixed with each other rather comfortably by that time. I think that was an immigrant problem or a second-generation problem that didn't seep down to the third generation.
Third generation, yeah. How did the city change as your father was growing up then?
Well, there were a lot of, you said that the Italians lived on the west side, but actually was a large number of ethnic groups on the west side. It was a melting pot. And as my father grew, everybody moved to the east side, the northeast side particularly. And the west side became, I don't know, sort of like Back to the Future. The neighborhood that was at one time one of the best neighborhoods had now become an impoverished neighborhood on the west side. The west side didn't have a whole lot of industry. It didn't have a whole lot of tax base, and it sort of fell apart in the 60s and the 70s. It began in the 40s and the 50s.
Yeah. But during the period that your dad would be growing up, I would imagine that the city was booming. Would that be correct?
Yeah, well, until you get into the Depression. Now, there were 45,000 people in Rockford when my grandfather moved there in about 1912. By the time you get to 1929, it's 85,000. Population actually goes backwards during the Depression, not by much, but it certainly doesn't grow. And then, of course, during World War II, when you have Rockford's an industrial town, and when you had a lot of people moving from various parts of the country, particularly the South, into Rockford, the population began to swell again. And by the time you get to the 1960s, it's 135,000.
Yeah. Want to put your headphones on? We've got a call. A listener would like to speak with us, so let's take this call. A listener in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Yes. I can't hear you, but can you hear me?
We can hear you fine.
Great. I was just curious as to whether of your great-grandfather Abraham's other children, whether they made it to America. Were they caught by the Second World War? Did they deal with the Nazi concentration camps? And of the family that remains, and I'm just curious as to how many maintained their connection to their Jewish roots, the children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren.
Okay, good questions.
Yeah, those were good questions. Actually, Anna moved to Detroit, where she reputedly was married to one of the Purple Gang members. They were bootleggers in Detroit. And Rachel moved to Canada, Winnipeg, I believe, and they kind of lost track of her. Sam lived in Rockford until he died in 1949, and my grandfather, Lewis, eventually moved to California, to Los Angeles, where half the family settled, and half the family is still there. My great-uncle, Sruel, came to the United States because everybody else had come here, including my great-grandmother after my great-grandfather died, and didn't like it in the United States. And I make the point in the book that we talk about how people came to the United States and they eagerly sought what the United States had to offer, and they worshipped at the Statue of Liberty. But truth is, a third of the people that came to this country during that large immigration went back home. And he was one of them. He just couldn't take the United States. He couldn't take the hustle and bustle and the crime in the streets in Chicago, and he didn't like the big towns, and he liked a small village where he had his own house. And so he went back, and as a matter of fact, Romania was not there was not the decimation of the Jewish population in Romania in the same way there were in other countries like Poland, because Romania was an ally of Nazi Germany. Therefore, the Nazis did not invade Romania. Now, the Romanian fascists didn't treat Jews very well either, but they didn't. There weren't wholesale deportations in the way there were in Poland. In fact, about half of the Jews in Romania survived World War II. There are 750,000 prior to the war, and a little under half of that still remain. But they're not very comfortable, obviously, and they get a Jewish foreign minister who negotiates to get large numbers of Jews to move to Israel. And so by the time we get into the 1960s, there's only about 8,000 Jews left in Romania. But there wasn't the same kind of wholesale slaughter that there were in other countries. And in fact, my great uncle Sruel was one of them who moved to Israel with his family.
And what happened to him there?
Well, they sort of lost track of him. But, you know, I checked the internet while I was writing this book, and there was a Michael Leibovich who was killed in the Israeli army. So I would guess that was Sruel's grandson or great grandson.
Have you ever tried to get hold of your cousins?
You mean in Israel?
Around the world, it seems like.
Well, I know I talked to almost every one of my cousins for the book. Some I hadn't seen in 40 years. The only ones I didn't reach were Sruel's descendants, and I didn't know how to get a hold of them. I tried several ways, but there wasn't any way to reach them.
And how do you spell your last name, sir?
L-I-E-B as in boy, O-V as in Victor, I-C-H.
Leibovich.
Yep, that's the only spelling. Anybody that spells his name or her name that way is descended from our family. There are no other people who spell their name that way. There's lots of different derivations of that, Leibowitz and Leibowitz, mm-hmm. and even Leibovich spelled L-E-I, but if you spell your name L-I-E-B-O-V-I-C-H, you're related to me.
L-I-E.
Yes.
Okay, thank you. You're very welcome. Interesting.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for the call this afternoon. Well, tell us how the family got the name Leibovich, because Lewis was Lewis, son of Abraham.
Right. We're not really sure. It could be that they never had last names in a small town. As you say, his name was maybe Lewis, son of Abraham. But I've talked to Romanian historians, and they kind of doubt that it was a large enough town they did have last names. It might have been the name Leibovici, which is a very common Romanian Jewish name, and they just got changed somehow to Ellis Island. It might have been Leibovich before they left. We're just not sure. I'm guessing that if the name Leibovich originated here, it would originate with my Uncle Sam, great Uncle Sam, who came here two or three years before my grandfather.
Yeah. Can you tell us a little bit more about Panciu, Romania? It had a large Jewish population. Today it's known for its wines, this region, and apparently it's long been known for its wines. Has any of your generation of the family traveled back to Romania?
No, actually, I met a woman on campus who was from Panciu. She was a postdoctoral student, and actually I sort of describe in the beginning of the book that scene where I meet with her. She offered to tour, you know, to guide us around Panciu, but she also said that there weren't any Jews in Panciu, and she looked kind of puzzled when I asked her if there were Jews in Panciu. She couldn't remember anybody being Jewish, and then she emailed me later to say her mother remembered one Jewish family. So there wouldn't be any remnants of our family there, or even the friends of the family. And I guess there was an earthquake in 1977 in that area and destroyed most of the buildings, so really wouldn't be much even of the buildings left. So I decided against traveling there to try to. We had talked about it. My brother and I were going to do it, but I didn't see that it was going to help very much.
Yeah. So has that community, from the conversation you had with the postdoc student, has that community recovered at all from the earthquake?
Yeah. They've built kind of squatty buildings. They're all cement buildings that aren't too attractive, but they're practical. Except for some access to the internet, one television station, a couple radio stations, and some very ugly-looking small cars, the place is the same as it was 100 years ago when my grandfather left.
Interesting. Well, we got to talk about your grandmother, Bess. I like her.
Yeah, she worked in a clothing factory like 75 hours a week, and educated herself by going to night school, so that by the time she was a young woman, she spoke perfect English, which is not easy. And unlike my grandfather, more than my grandfather, she pushed hard for the kids to be educated. There's even a scene where they force my father to play the violin. He can't play the violin. He has no interest in playing the violin. So after a while, screech, 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 my grandfather takes the violin and smashes it against the wall. Then he has to go out and buy another one the next day, and my father has to go back to practicing again.
Tell us about their courtship and the role her brother played in it.
Actually, my grandfather courted her sister first.
Right.
And while he's courting her sister, he notices her, and he kind of loses interest and gets interested in my grandmother. And they have an argument because she's a passionate socialist, and he doesn't think women should be about politics, and they have an argument about it. And so they separate for a year, and it's my great-uncle, my grandmother's brother, who goes to him and says, you know, you really ought to get together again. And my great-uncle was an actor on the Yiddish stage, and my grandfather doesn't believe that he's sincere. He thinks that they just want to get her married off, and he's not sure he's going to do it, but he misses her so much that he swallows his pride.
Hmm. Bess Greenberg.
Yes, Bess Greenberg.
Yeah. Well, let's return to Rockford in the 1920s with your grandfather's hard work. He eventually was able to buy a truck, so the cart wasn't necessary anymore. What was that time like?
Well, actually, it did quite well in the 20s. Right after World War I, there was a lot of devastation in Europe, and they needed American products. And so it was a reasonably good time to make a living. They squirreled away a lot of money, and he was able to buy his truck with cash. They never bought anything on credit. Everything was paid for with cash. And his ability to buy an international truck allows him to expand his business. And he can even drive down to Florida and pick up his own load of watermelons occasionally. The roads aren't very good in those days, but if you're adventurous, you can drive all the way to Florida. And he's doing really well. The family's growing, and they decide they need another house. When, summer of 1929, he decides he's finally going to take on some debt. And, of course, you know what happens 3 months later. The stock market crash. And so they were in desperate straits in the 30s. He has to convert to buying and selling scrap metal and old clothes. He cuts into strips to sell his cloth. And because people they don't buy fruits and vegetables every day as they were doing so during the time when they had ice boxes. By now they have refrigerators. They don't need to buy their fruits and vegetables every day. So he goes into the scrap metal and the and selling cloth.
Yeah. And how many children did they have?
They had five.
Five, okay. And the Depression years passed by, and 1940, 1941 comes along, and they make a big move.
Yeah, my grandfather's got diabetes, and I might add I inherited from him, so did my father. And he's got hay fever, and he's got asthma, and he's got you name it, he's got all kinds of allergies, and he's got a bad heart, and the doctor says if you don't move to a warmer climate, you're not going to make it through another winter. So in the summer of 1941, they moved to Los Angeles, where my uncle has already gotten a job working as a machinist, and he sort of smooths the way for them. So there's my aunt, my uncle, and my grandparents living in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm. And part of the family, though, remains in Rockford?
A very small part at the end of the book that I talk about the fact that there was something like 40 or 50 relatives from the extended family in Rockford in 1962, and now there's five left.
What happened to the family during the war years?
My father fought in World War II. My uncle Ted fought in World War II. My uncle Ken on my mother's side fought in World War II, and I spent a whole chapter on World War II. It's sort of like that movie, The Winds of War, television series, I guess it was, that he jumps around from the Eastern Front in Russia to the Pacific, and so it's kind of hokey the way they do it, but they want to get you a feel of all parts of the war. Well, I didn't have to have anybody jump around because my uncle was in the Pacific. My uncle Ken was in the Pacific. My Uncle Ted was on bombardier flying missions over France and Germany, and my father was stationed as an infantryman in Italy. So I skipped from one person to the other describing the experiences they have during World War II, and that's a little more documented. Most of the book rely on oral history, but that's a little more documented because there were letters and other written material that were left from that time period.
Yeah. When did they all return to the U.S.?
My father came back in August of 1945, and my uncle, who was a colonel by that time, worked his way up from private to colonel during World War II, came back in December of 1945 because he was commander of an Air Force base, an Army Air Corps base in what is now East Germany.
And when they came back, did they go to school, marriage? That's what I would assume happened.
All of the brothers were married before World War II, wow, except for my Uncle Ted, who volunteered and had left his fiancée waiting. And they got married immediately upon his returning. My Aunt Alice was the youngest, and she was only 17 in 1945. In fact, her high school graduation picture from Roosevelt High School in Los Angeles is the cover picture for the book. It's my grandfather and grandmother standing on either side of her with her graduation gown on.
Proud parents.
Yes.
And she apparently was devastated. Alice was devastated when your grandfather passed away.
Yeah, she was the apple of his eye. He had four boys, and he always wanted a girl, and finally, the last child, she was born 5 years after my uncle, the youngest boy. He finally had a daughter, and so he was crazy about her.
Yeah. And Bess, she was really distraught.
Well, you know, in those days, women didn't have careers. They didn't... they raised their children, but then the children went out on their own, and while, you know, mother was always there, the wife took over. And so really he was all she had left. And when he died, she had trouble even getting up to go to the funeral.
Yeah. Speaking of widows, maybe we should talk a little bit more about Fanny, because she came to the U.S., following Abraham's death.
Yeah, and she wanted to live with her children. And I point out in the book that if all the children had remained in Poncho, she would have comfortably lived in her cottage there with her children looking after her and the community looking after her with the people that she had known all her life. But they've all moved to the United States, and he was the only one left. And when he dies, she's got to come to the United States. But she doesn't like it here. She never learns to speak English. The grandchildren, they're kind of afraid of her. She speaks a strange language, and she has strange mannerisms, and she's kind of grumpy. And they don't have room for her in the house. They've got three children and the two parents living in an 800-square-foot house, and they've got to try to fit her in. So she kind of lives with each one of the children, and it's not a very comfortable existence.
Yeah. She never got back to Romania?
No, she didn't. Yeah. Her son, Srul, went back, but she never did.
Yeah. So Bess and Lewis had five children. How many grandchildren?
18. Actually, 19. One of them died at birth. There was 18 that lived to adulthood.
And great-grandchildren?
37.
37. Any great-greats?
Oh, yes. There's several. In fact, I say in the book they're probably within 20 years they'll be 50 or 60.
Well, does the family ever get together for reunions?
No, it's not a close family. That's the ironic thing about this book. I mean, I wrote this book, and I get into, I mean, I really researched the relatives who lived in Florida, in California. I hadn't seen them in a long time, and I really did a lot of research on them to capture their lives. But the truth of the matter is that some of them I hadn't seen 40 years, and I had cousins that lived in the same town. I remember one of my cousins I was interviewing, and she said, I remember I was in your house once, and she lived in the same time she was town, and she was my cousin, and she remembered she was in our house once.
Hmm.
Some families, you know, the immediate family is close, but the extended family is not.
Yeah. I would imagine that the extended family, though, is really pleased that you've done this book.
A number of them have had good things to say about it. Some of them weren't so sure. I was made up my mind at the beginning that I was going to be the objective reporter on this, and I was going to report it, even though I'm in the middle of a lot of it toward the end. I was not going to sway it one way or the other. I was going to report the facts. And except for situations where people were victimized from outside the family, I was not going to take one side or the other. I was simply going to report exchanges of conversations and information. And I'm not sure that some of them believe that I could actually do that.
Yeah. You've got three children.
Yes, I do.
How old are they, and have they read the book? What are they?
They're reading it now. Yeah. Nobody read it while I was writing it. My only one that read it was my brother, because he insisted. He gave me a lot of good information, and he insisted he wanted to read it. But other than my brother, nobody read it until now. So they're all in the midst of reading it. I was kind of surprised because, you know, some people have said to me, why should I read about your family? And it's like saying, why should I read Dickens because he writes about people in the streets of England? Or why should I read about Michener because he writes about fictitious people in various cultures? It's not really about my family. It's about what my family represents. And I think that if you look at it in that way, it doesn't matter whose family it is. And I've been surprised at, frankly, surprised at how positive reaction I've had to this book, that people have read it who were skeptical to begin with, and they've really reacted quite well.
Hmm. Let's take another call before we're out of time here. A listener in Champaign, line one, hi.
Yes, I'm curious about the young woman who had socialist leanings, and I'd like to know more about her. And was her name Bess or Beth?
Bess.
Bess with an S.
Yes, two S's.
With two S's. Was she the Irish woman?
No, that was my grandfather's Jewish wife, Bess Greenberg. The Irish was the Glavin family, and actually the Irish marries an English woman, and that doesn't mix too well. But Bess was a socialist because she worked in a sweatshop, so to speak, and she thought that workers in this country were being taken advantage of. And her husband was a socialist as well. He had tattoos on the insides of both his arms with two hands shaking, which are the socialist symbol in Europe. She actually participated in a socialist protest when my grandmother or my grandfather was courting her and got thrown in jail, and that's sort of what led to the argument between them that he didn't think women should be involved in politics like that. He agreed with everything she represented, but she should have stayed out of it, and they split up for a year over that.
Were their children also following both the Judaism and the socialism?
Oh, yes. My father and my uncles and my aunt were Orthodox Jews, but not socialists. In fact, my father was pretty much an independent voter, but they built up a fairly extensive business by the time we get into the 60s, and he sort of became a Republican because he didn't like unions, and he felt that the country was taking too much away from business people.
Hmm. No, thank the listener for her call this afternoon. Well, to wrap up here, I suspect you would encourage people to tell their family stories and to write them down and to take care of these things, photographs, memories, documents.
Yeah, I actually started this just a few years too late. Four of the relatives, including my father, died while I was writing this. And my father couldn't function too well by the time I started it, and I couldn't capture a lot of things that I needed by asking him questions. I had to go to my uncles, and they weren't always all that forthcoming. I think that you lose something if you don't trace these things and keep them, even if you don't write a book, just keep them written down somewhere. This is not a genealogy. This is an historical narrative. It's a running narrative where there are characters, and they have conversations, and they have lives, and we walk through their lives. And in that way, it's a book, but you don't have to always do it that way.
Yeah. There, we've got to leave it. We're out of time. Lou, thanks so much for coming in this
Well, thank you. It's always good dealing with Rockfordites.
All right. Lou Leibovich has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. His latest book is Abraham's Rhyme, The Story of an American Family. And our guest will be in the Author's Corner of the Illini Union Bookstore next Thursday afternoon, April 26th, 2007, from 4 to 6 p.m. 8 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time, settlement prices should be in from Kansas City and Chicago. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thank you very much, Celeste. From the Chicago Board of Trade on this Friday afternoon, futures finished the day like this. Nearby May wheat for the soft red up 6 cents today, 514 the high, the low at 90 and a quarter. That's $4.90 and a quarter, and a settlement price at $5.02. Once again, they settled 6 higher for the day. July futures, 525 the high, the low at 503, settled at 514 and three quarters, up 7. And September's were up 7 as well, 516 and three quarters, the settlement price there, the high at 24, the bottom at 07. December contract in the wheat pit, 522 in Chicago for the high, the bottom ended at $5.11, settlement price at 521. They were up 6.5, and the March contract 6.5 higher. At 524.5, they had the same high price as their settlement, and their low was at 514 and three quarters. Once again, the settle at 524.5 in the March wheat, up 6.5 cents for the afternoon. May corn futures now, 376 from Chicago for the high, the low at 358.5, a settlement price at $3.16.5. They were off 10.75 this afternoon. July futures, 387, the high, the low at 69.75, settlement price at $3.72, down 10.25. And September's, 378, the high, the low at 69.25, settlement price at 370.5, down 6.75. And December futures, 379.75, the high, the low at 71.75, settlement price at $3.74.75, they were down 5.25. The March, 387, the high, the low at 383. Settlement price at 385.25. They were off a nickel for the day. May futures, 393, the high, the low at 390. Settlement price at 392.5, down 3.5. And July futures, 99.5 on the top. The bottom at 393. Settlement price at 396.5. They were off 4.25. September futures up 1 for the day. 387, the high, the low at 381. Settlement price.